This is a CNA podcast.
When you think about COVID-19, the race towards a vaccine, how would you describe your thoughts about that in five words?
Application of science in real time.
It is fast, unprecedented global partnership coordination.
This is Heart of the Matter, and I'm Lin Su Ling. There's so much all of us would give to return to normal, to a time before the coronavirus. But when the world thought we were finally turning the corner on COVID-19, fresh waves of infections broke out this week across Vietnam, Australia and Japan, countries that took early measures to contain it. Increasingly, it looks like only the silver bullet of a vaccine might put us back on a path towards a post-COVID world. Without it, a return to normality carries huge risk from a respiratory virus that humans have no prior immunity towards, for which there are no life-saving treatments as yet. Without it, more livelihoods will be threatened, and the jobless rates in Singapore, which just climbed to a decades-long high, will drag on for some time yet. And so the fate of billions lie in the hands of the few on the hot pursuit of a viable vaccine while we all keep our fingers crossed. But thankfully, these last few days have also brought some good news on this front. US drug maker Moderna is now in the final stages of testing on its experimental candidate. Another frontrunner in this race involves human trials right here in Singapore by Duke NUS Medical School. But what will it take to go from where we are to a COVID-19 vaccination program being rolled out in Singapore? What regulatory and production hurdles must be crossed? And who should get the vaccine first? My two guests calling in are distinguished names in healthcare world. Professor Wee Eng Leong is Deputy Director at the Emerging Infectious Disease Program, Duke NUS Medical School. Hi, Eng Leong.
Hello.
And Dr. Jacqueline Ing Ru Lo is Head of Mission and World Health Organization Representative to Malaysia, Brunei and Singapore. Hi, Ing Ru. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Su Ling, for having us here.
Now, I just want to start by asking both of you a very quick take. How optimistic are you that we will find a vaccine that works by 2021 or even 2020? What's your take?
I don't think we'll get a vaccine by this year. I think next year is possible, especially around the middle of next year towards the second half. And, you know, this is against a backdrop where a normal timeline to develop a vaccine is about 10 to 15 years. We're trying to do it in less than 2 years. And that's already a very remarkable journey to shrink that timeline by such a long time frame.
Do you agree with that, Ingo?
Yes, I fully agree with that.
Oh, dear. Okay. So, Ingo, you know, there's so much banking on a COVID vaccine and people are asking, why is it taking so long? Could you walk our listeners through the various phases in a vaccine development and the purpose that each phase serves?
Maybe just to start off, I wanted to say a few words because I would really like to take this opportunity to congratulate all the frontline workers who have been working so hard to save lives and all the researchers, including Professor Oi and his team, working so hard to find a vaccine. We have been working in an extraordinary effort to accelerate vaccine development. So usually you have four components, what you need for vaccines, having vaccines getting to the people. So the first one is to have an effective, safe vaccine. The second one is to have the regulatory approval, the licensing. The third one is to have the production capacity. And the fourth one is really to bring the vaccine to the people. And this whole process takes 17 to 20 years. But as Eng Leong said, it's now being accelerated. And just the clinical trial phase is now also already accelerated. So maybe just as a brief summary.
So just to bring Eng Leong into this conversation as well, do you both think that enough has been done around the world to fast-track this while maintaining safety and standards? I know you said this is extraordinary. Is it extraordinary enough for a COVID-19 world?
Obviously, nothing is ever fast enough, right? Even by the time the vaccine got into clinical trials, several weeks have already gone by. Many people have suffered from COVID-19. People have died from it. So can we do it faster in the future? Of course, we should try, right? But given where we were and where we are now, it's still quite a big leap. Is the vaccine safe enough? Only clinical trials and time will tell. But the early indication is that it will be reasonably well tolerated. That yes, there will be side effects, but I think they are bearable.
So Eng Leong, if I may, you're involved in LunaCoV-19, the vaccine that will see human trials start by Duke NUS pharma firm Arcturus. How far along is it? And I suppose the magic question that all our listeners want to hear is how long more before you can place one in my doctor's syringe?
Well, we are right now screening the healthy volunteers and then we'll start injecting the vaccine into them as soon as the clinicians think that it's the right time. So everything has to be lined up. So it's happening as we speak. How soon can we get that to the doctors? As I said, I think what we need to show, first of all, that this vaccine is safe and it has minimal side effects. So even when the recipients get side effects, they're mild. And then two, that they would elicit a good immune response. And that three, this immune response will protect against infection and against people developing COVID-19. All that, unfortunately, will take a bit of time. At the most optimistic, it'll be around this time next year that we know that it works. Given the way that this vaccine is made and all that, the scaling up can be very fast. So, you know, hopefully the second half of next year will be when, in Singapore at least, we can start giving the vaccine to our population.
Back to the idea of volunteers, you said that we have about 100 volunteers for this program, but how are you able to find a representative sample given that usually this would involve volunteers in places where there are high numbers of COVID-19 cases? And what happens after they sign up? Could you walk us through the process?
In a way, Singapore is a good place to do a clinical trial because actually the infection hasn't been that prevalent. Indeed, in the dorms and all that, yes, we've had a big outbreak, but in the community, that's not going to be a problem. So ideally, the kind of people we want are those who are healthy, aged between 21 to 50 to begin with, no past major medical history, and that they can receive this vaccine and they volunteer, sign the consent and all that. So that's the start. I suspect that majority of these will be negative for SARS-CoV-2. They would never have seen it before. And so any immune response will be to the vaccine, not because they've had prior infection. From there, then we'll expand the cohort, right? Once we show that it's safe in young and healthy adults, then we can expand it to the older adults, to the children and all that, so that we have a coverage from the very young to the very old.
But could you take us through the regulatory hurdles that you've had to cross so far? And do you foresee that to be a challenge going forward? What has the experience been?
So the first thing that we needed to convince the regulators was that this is safe and that this has a chance of working. And by that, I mean it produces a good immune response in preclinical animal models. So we've looked at safety in very unique ways. So usually in the past, what people would do is put a vaccine in and just observe whether anything happens to the animals, like weight loss or anything. We took that several steps further. We actually asked what genes were turned on, what genes were turned off when you put this vaccine into animals. Because fundamentally, the side effects are also controlled by genes. So whether we get headache, whether we get muscle ache and all that is because of a set of genes that are turned on and off. And so we looked at all of that in the animals and we're quite confident that the response, in particular the inflammatory response that causes this the side effects in humans, we don't see that happening in the mouse models. I'm very hopeful that when this goes into humans, that this is safe. And that's the data that was presented to the regulators that enabled us to get into clinical trials that quickly.
So Ingrid, I want to bring you into this conversation. There are actually so many candidates out there and about 20-something at the front of this race. Many are getting funding from organizations, private foundations. But as much as the search for a vaccine has moved at a rapid pace and turbocharged by the prospects of gold at the end of this rainbow, the thing is, like you both point out, it's a very painful, laborious, expensive process. So then what is your view on whether this competition is a good thing?
Maybe just to step back, we are now 8 months into the epidemic. Or in 8 months, we now have about 200 vaccine candidates which have gone or are going to start to go into clinical trials. And out of those, 25 have started or are going to start human trials. And 4 candidate vaccines have gone to phase 3. There are 5 trials ongoing. So that's unprecedented in terms of speed. This is a global effort. It's a global partnership. So WHO has from the beginning been coordinating this vaccine partnerships for the research and development. And it is important in emergencies to coordinate the development. So to share information, what kind of types of vaccine platforms are available, which companies are working on what kind of candidates, the production, and also to coordinate the manufacturing and the market and the distribution. So we have actually established very early on access to vaccine and diagnostics and therapeutics initiative. We call it Access to COVID-19 Tools Accelerator. And one of the pillars is COVAX, it's the Access to COVID-19 Vaccines, which looks at manufacturing and distribution. So this is going to look at equal distribution. So to avoid this competition, like one company goes to one country, says, this is what I offer you. Do you want it? If you want it, subscribe now. So what we do is we will, this initiative will negotiate with manufacturers and also coordinate the access between the countries. And now the proposal is to look at the end of 2021 for 2 billion doses to 20% of the world's population, the most vulnerable. So just as an example, so coordination in emergency situation is very critical.
But surely who gets there first in terms of the drug company that's able to develop the vaccine first will make the most money though. Do you think that a winner-takes-all scenario is still likely?
So this is why we have been coordinating with partners, including the private sector. So the private industry is part of this COVAX initiative. So they are very interested in this because there is a pooled procurement. We are securing the procurement. There is an advance payment. I think about 160 countries have subscribed. A number of countries who are actually self-financed through their funding and will make some upfront payments. And so we are helping to secure markets for the pharmaceutical industry in an equitable and fair way.
I want to put a pin into that because I think we do want to get into what it determines a fair and equitable distribution and production. But then we're talking about the research. And at the end of the day, surely when one company gets there first, what happens to the rest of the candidates in the race? Are you saying that they won't just drop out?
I don't think so. You know, if you look at the history of vaccine development, and the classic one was supposed to be polio, the first polio vaccine worked, right? It worked to prevent poliomyelitis, the disease. But the one is that it needed a cold chain because of the way the vaccine is prepared. Two is that it had to begin given by an injection, so you need a trained healthcare worker to deliver the vaccine. And three, it doesn't protect against carriage. So people can still carry the virus, but they don't get the disease. The second vaccine that came along stopped all three. It stopped carriage. You just swallow the vaccine. You don't have to give an injection. In resource-poor countries, it's much easier to develop. And the cold chain issue wasn't that much, and therefore the logistics wasn't that much of a problem as much as the inactivated vaccine. That solved a lot of problems. So the second vaccine then became the preferred vaccine until recently after we got rid of polio. For COVID-19, as Ingo said, right, we've only known this virus for about 8 months. There's a lot that we don't understand about this disease. We don't understand how long immunity will last, whether there's a need to give a second dose. Can you give the same vaccine a second time, or do you need a different vaccine so that they trigger it differently? There's a lot of unknown. And finally, the number of people, you know, suffering from COVID-19, the number of people at risk of disease is so large now that I don't think one single company can solve the problem. This is going to be a multinational, multi-agency effort. So we will need multiple vaccines to deal with this infection.
So it's not just the speed of the trials and who gets to that finishing line. It almost sounds like you're saying there are other factors that go into the consideration of this, the effectiveness and the side effects. Could you both maybe walk our listeners through what other factors come into play when vaccine development and production actually then gets there?
Well, I'll start. The other thing about the vaccine development is it's actually very differentiated. We're all coming at this with different technologies. The vaccines do slightly different things. And so how well one vaccine performs doesn't affect the rest. So each of them will bring a slightly different effect on the immune response and therefore possibly the how well it protects against COVID-19 as well. All that will come into play in terms of how well it works. Secondly, how easy is it to be manufactured? Some technologies depend heavily on growing the virus. That's a bit of a problem because a SARS coronavirus 2 has to be grown in a biosafety level 3 containment.
What does that mean though, biosafety?
Yeah, so biosafety levels go from 1 to 4, 1 being the least stringent and 4 being the most stringent. So 1 will be a classic bacteria that we use in the lab to teach students, whereas 4 will be like your viruses like Ebola that will kill at least 80-90% of people they infect. So 3 is fairly high. In other words, the infrastructure we need to manufacture this virus is actually very expensive. Right, because of all the bells and whistles that need to be put in to make sure that the virus can be grown safely. So then there are other technologies that don't rely on that. You can manufacture them under less stringent kind of infrastructure. But at the same time, maybe those vaccines, in terms of the scaling, the scale at which you manufacture for clinical trial is very different from the scale that you manufacture for commercial application. So all that comes into play. So there's a lot of unknown. And I think even if the first few vaccine candidates finish phase three trials and show that it works, a lot of these post-trial issues in terms of the commercial manufacturing, the marketing, the logistics, all that matters. So it will affect access to vaccines at the end of the day.
It's great that you brought up manufacturing and supply chains, and I really want to get into that. Ingru, could you tell us, if a vaccine must be produced and it's somewhere else in some other part of the world, how ready are airports and logistical chains and companies in delivering the vaccines? What's your sense?
For the logistics delivery, that shouldn't be a major issue, but I think the manufacturing capacity would be the major issue. 2 billion doses is a lot, so we have 25 human clinical trials ongoing, and just the number of individuals enrolled is several thousands, right, for trial. That's the capacity we have now. You have to ramp up the production to billions of people, and that's the major bottleneck. I think the logistics for transportation, that can be resolved, and there are many mechanisms through commercial distributors, but also through distributors by the UN and other agencies, which would be available. But you have to have a stockpile, and I think the main issue would be the administration to get the vaccine out to the people, because we are used to have vaccination programs for children, but we don't have vaccination programs for adults. That has to be thought about. How do you do that? How do you get herd immunity among adults, bring them to come to vaccination, elderly, above 65 years of age? So that's a huge, huge public health effort and undertaking, and clearly something which we are now looking at and working at.
You said so much, and I really want to go and unpack every part of it. But just going back to the point about supply and logistical chains, the challenge also during this whole period is that shipping and cargo companies have come under huge strain under the COVID-19 global economy. How confident are you that they can ramp up? Because as it stands, it seems like trade around the world have come down a bit.
We can't go on with this restriction that we are practicing now, right? I mean, let's just take Singapore in the first instance. I mean, the society has already paid, what, billions of dollars just for this, what, few months of shutdown or circuit breaker, as we called it, right? How long can we keep this up for? I'm not sure that we can keep this up for that long. At some point, these things will have to open, perhaps not to the extent that it would be really back to, you know, 2019, 2018 kind of volume. But we have to open up our borders. We have to open up our trade routes and all that. Singapore Airlines has to be able to operate. Otherwise, the whole country will just collapse well before a vaccine comes into play.
And apart from all those borders being opened up, the other question also is, how confident are you that logistical companies can ship unprecedented amounts of fragile vials or vaccines?
We have to be very clear. There's only one way that we can open up the economies totally and be living safely as before, and that's to have a vaccine that is safe and that works. The infrastructure and the efforts, the preparations for the distribution of vaccines is also part of the discussions at the COVAX facility, and these efforts must be made. So it's not that you have 2 billion doses shipped in one go. It will come in gradually, right? So as the production ramps up. But I'm pretty confident that will be possible with the capacity of the manufacturing increasing.
So one question is, can a vaccine be wholly researched, produced and distributed in the country? I think that has come up a lot because in June, PM Lee Hsien Loong talked about how Singapore intends to offer fill and finish contract manufacturing services to vaccine developers. And we also know that in Singapore, there are a couple of big pharma companies and they have manufacturing capabilities here, including GlaxoSmithKline, who's in the competition to develop a vaccine. Can it be done in one country?
I think in a big country, that's not an issue, right? It's a country the size of Singapore, whether all that can be done. Technically, yes, it can be done. The question is, how sustainable would it be? After COVID, how are we going to keep these various pieces commercially viable? That's the harder question to tackle. Because if we do it in Singapore, then obviously we have to have a market to sustain it. Because the domestic market isn't going to be big enough to keep a biopharma like that going. Could it be ASEAN? Could it go stretch beyond that? Maybe Southeast Asia as well as East Asia, that's a much harder question to contemplate. And certainly I'm in no position to answer that question. You need an economist to guide this.
So I guess one of my last couple of questions is, you mentioned about the multilateral initiatives that have sprung up to help with the production distribution of the vaccine when one eventually gets there. Talk to us about the COVID-19 Vaccine Global Access Facility, COVAX, that you've mentioned, and how will it determine fast and equitable access to a vaccine, given that over 70 countries have signed up to it?
75 countries at the moment have expressed interest in the COVAX facility. Actually, some more who are not registered on the website, where the letters came a few days later. And 165 countries in total now, that's about 60% of the world's population. And they have developed countries and high-income countries, even G20 economies among them. There are several pillars working on that. One is the negotiations with the manufacturers. So there's a group of manufacturers. There's about the procurement mechanisms. There's the distribution mechanisms. There's the logistics. And there's also the scientific guidance. And the WHO is responsible, for example, for the guidance, which populations to target, with age groups, how to administer the vaccines.
But how do you determine which country gets how many batches, though, when the first one is rolled out?
There is a formula for the different countries based on the size of the population, about the population of healthcare workers, elderly, more than 65 years of age, and also the level of the epidemic. So there are formulas for that. And this is being proposed to the member states. It's worked out by the member states together with WHO based on these formulas.
Is there nothing to do with the funding that each country provides as well? Is it purely based on the health advice?
As I said, there are 75 countries which are self-funding, so with their own funding, and there are about 90 lower-income countries that could be supported through voluntary donations. So there is a massive effort going on through partners and through WHO to mobilize resources to this fund to procure the vaccine.
Okay, so just rolling over to the last part of this podcast, one question that has come out really is, even after crossing all these hurdles and countries do get their batches, experts have pointed out that demand will outstrip supply many more times. And I guess this is where I ask about triage. We polled our followers on Facebook on who should get priority, and this is the men on the street, and they said that healthcare workers on the front lines, the elderly and the vulnerable with multiple conditions, should get that vaccine first. And ironically, this is seemingly the same as what many experts have mentioned as well, including the US Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Is that something you both agree with, and why? Or do you have anything to add to that?
WHO, as I said, is developing guidance on how to distribute the vaccines and who to prioritize together with partners and also member states and researchers. And the proposal is actually to prioritize healthcare workers, social workers, the frontline workers. That's about 1% of the global population. Then adults over 65 years of age, the elderly who have a high risk developing severe disease and dying. That's about 8% of the global population, and other high-risk adults who have hypertension or diabetes, with high blood sugar. It means people who also have shown from the data where we have seen that these are at higher risk for having severe disease outcomes or of dying. So this is this 20% of the population, the 2 billion doses provided by the COVAX facility.
So I see Eng-Yong nodding along, and therefore this is where I ask the mischievous question, where those are the population segments I think everybody can agree with. But what happens after those people have been cleared? Who's next after that in line? Eng-Yong, I'm just going to volley over this to you. What do you think?
Sure.
That's a tough question, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. In fact, I would add that whilst those are clearly and obviously the at-risk populations that we certainly must vaccinate and should vaccinate early, we also have to be guided by the data, right? Because the older the vaccine recipient, actually the poorer the immune response. Now, we don't fully understand why. We all think that there's some level of this thing called immunosenescence, where the immune system also ages. And so when you give the vaccine, it actually doesn't work so well. Then in that context, under certain circumstances or certain situations, it may be preferable to vaccinate the family members looking after the elderly. Mm. They won't pass the virus on to those vulnerable to disease. And so that the modeling, the mathematical modeling on how best to deploy the vaccine could also shape the policy decisions on how to best utilize the limited doses of vaccine. That has to be guided by the phase 3 data as well. So that's another consideration. Let's say if we can cover the people at risk of infection and risk of disease, then obviously the next stage is trying to build up that herd immunity in the population. We cannot vaccinate 100% of the population. And that's okay, because you don't need 100% to be vaccinated. We just need enough to stop transmission. And given the kind of spread of SARS coronavirus 2, where one case likely passes on to two other persons to become cases, one person to two or three. So if you do the mathematics, about 50% to 70% coverage or immunity levels should be enough to prevent outbreaks.
Do you have anything to add to that, Ingru?
I agree with that, yeah. Let's have a vaccine first.
Yeah.
So just in closing, so much of the news reports and opinion pieces out there characterize the COVID-19 vaccine race as one of a mad dash. But it kind of sounds like what you're saying is that this is a long drawn marathon with many moving parts and many things that need to be bolted down in discussion with many countries and partners. Is that a fair characterization? Are we missing any other complexities and challenges?
If you use the marathon analogy, instead of trying to run 42 kilometers, the race is now shrunk to about 5 kilometers. So it's a lot faster, a lot more hectic. So we'll see.
I think it's unprecedented. It's a global pandemic. It's a global emergency. The vaccine development, also development of therapeutics, has been unprecedented. And in particular, I would like to say in Asia, many countries have done very well to prevent the further spread of the epidemic. They have flattened the curves, including in Singapore. So that's very important. There are measures, although difficult to sustain in the long term, but there are some individual measures which can be sustained. And this is personal individual behaviors like hand hygiene, respiratory hygiene, wearing a face mask when appropriate, and keeping physical distance. So that's complementing the public health measures we already know, with isolating, testing and treating and tracing the contacts and quarantining them. Some things we know we work, but we know also we need a vaccine. But until we have a vaccine, please adhere to the new normal. Help your governments really to make it work.
And there you have it from the experts. The mad rush towards the COVID-19 vaccine actually is one that will require careful planning and much coordination among governments, drug companies, logistical chains to place one in our hands. Thank you to Ingru and Aeyong for coming on our podcast today. Heart of the Matter is made possible with our podcast editor Crispina Robert, research writer Erin Low, and our intern Yao Shun this week. I'm Lin Su Ling signing off.